Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Yeah, basically it's like a Groundhog Day meets Majora's Mask, something like that. Because you both have the idea that the game remains a space in which you can experiment everything, and nothing has real consequences, because at the end of the day, a time-eating dragon is going to eat everything you've done. But also this idea that you cannot save everybody, you cannot solve each problem on your own. You can just learn how people are working and what are their general problems. And yeah, the game is more about don't save individuals, like try to save people as a collective.
Sifter.com.au.
Hello, this is Lightmap from Sifter, our interview show. I'm Gianni. Today we explore a multiplayer tabletop-like game called Baladins, which has you looping back and forth in time. Thais Arias and Jean-Nicolas from Seed by Seed, and they are my guests on this episode. Before we jump into that, here's what's been making the news on Walkthrough, Sifter's news podcast. Let's go. Hi, I'm Gianni DiGiovanni.
And I'm Fiona Bartholomaeus.
And here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, 16th of June.
We wrap the big showcases Xbox, Ubisoft, Devolver, and share our favourites.
The next Dragon Age game has a new name and a new trailer. We discuss The Veil Guard.
Xbox has hinted again that they are working on a handheld device.
And beloved Australian indie studio League of Geeks is shutting down all projects and are now on hiatus.
You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website sifter.com.au every Sunday.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/discord.
Have you enjoyed the plotting and puzzling of a board game, but find it tricky to get all your friends together? I know that I have. Now, Baladins is a cute little game which captures all the joy of playing tabletop games with some clever loops in the mix. Thais and Jean, welcome to Lightmap. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for hosting us.
Now, tell me, what is Baladins?
Well, basically, you just said it very well. It's a game that is inspired by tabletop RPGs and that you can enjoy with up to 4 players. And yeah, it's like you play as paladins. So your job is to organize parties. And well, things are not going exactly as you planned this year. So you may have to handle a time-eating dragon.
Just classic adventure stuff, you know, just a time-eating dragon as you go. Tell me a little bit about the inspiration behind this game. It's obviously tabletop. You see little meeples as you are moving through the different turns in the game. But tell me, how did you come to this idea and when did you start working on it?
We had this thought at some point that people want to gather and share a story together. And we wonder, how is it possible to tell a story that up to 4 people can live through and also decide where each person can go and take decisions? So we were very, very much inspired by board games. We wanted to have like a board game party, but that you can have all together online, and that it would be also kind of easy to organize in a way. So all on top of each other, all of these ideas started to make sense in our minds, and we came up with first ideas called Fast Adventure, and then it grew up to become Baladins. So basically that's it.
When you were making it, did you have to prototype it with real paper, real elements, real little things? Is that how it kind of came about?
Yeah, actually, this is what we made. Like, our first prototype was kind of handcrafted using various board games pieces. And with that, and Antonin, who is our narrative designer and writer, was actually like doing the game master thing. And yeah, this is like the first prototype was basically it. And after that, we kind of reproduced it in a Miro board, because the team is kind of spread here. We are in Angoulême, but for example, Antonin is living in Paris. So we had to have the same kind of board game feeling. And so, yeah, we use Miro to do so. But fortunately, we got the chance to have an in-game prototype really quick.
The Miro boards are pretty powerful. Could you actually play it with, like, making choices inside that board? Is that how it was? Or were you kind of having to make a few sort of guesses, or, you know, a few allowances for that particular format?
At the time, the board needed a game master to be enjoyed. And since Antonin was still like in the process of inventing the whole story loop, it was actually pretty great, because I was able to iterate on the mechanical side and he was able to just come up with a different version of the story each time. So it was like a pretty powerful tool to iterate on both mechanics and stories at the same time.
Tell me about building in this loop, because one of the things that often feels challenging in games is, you know, making choices and worried that, you know, you've made maybe not the best choice, but you've got this built-in ability to return and retry different alternatives, different choices, meet different people, pick up different items. Tell me about how that kind of idea came about when making Paladins.
Basically, we wanted to have like a world that would simulate stories. And for that, it was interesting to see how one story, one quest could take different shapes depending on what you decide to do, what items you carry, what you did just before. So it was interesting to revisit the game. Also, one of our main inspiration in terms of design was The Yogue, a game that released on Steam in 2014. And also that gave birth to later, I mean, by inspiration to Monster Prom. And we took from these two games a lot of design bits. So we knew that having a story that's kind of short, that you can live together like an hour or an hour and a half adventure, was enough to have a fun session. So we wanted to have like a short session that you can come out having lived the story. But you may want to replay, and you may want to replay something different. So then this idea of the loop came from this design perspective. Like, you want to replay, you want to see something different. So then you would be able to replay and discover either different endings, but also different events that would show up differently depending on just randomness. So yeah, and then progressively, you would get information from one previous loop to the next, and you would play differently. You will, for example, you have encountered an issue once, and you know that this is not a way to solve the problem, and then you will try another approach, and you will have a different strategy. Maybe you will try to play collectively instead of being individualist, or the reverse is also true. So,
yeah, basically, it's like Groundhog Day meets Majora's Mask, something like that, because you both have the idea that the game remains a space in which you can experiment everything, and nothing has real consequences, because at the end of the day, a time-eating dragon is going to eat everything you've done. But also this idea that like, you cannot save everybody, you cannot solve each problem on your own, you can just learn how people are working and how, what are their general problems. And yeah, the game is more about like, don't save individuals, like try to save people as a collective.
I think that's what we've got to do in our real lives as well, isn't it? You know, try save everyone together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe video games are kind of political.
Yeah, I think possibly. You might be right there. Hey, it's interesting to me, you know, that multiplayer aspect of it. And you said as you go, you can either spend, you know, work together. And I noticed there was an element where the bonuses of your statistics from your RPG character could contribute together for completing a cause. But also there's that value of going off and doing your own thing. And maybe it might be valuable for one person to run off and go and do something specifically. Tell me about how you sort of had to adjust and change it, because it's playable by one person on their own versus making it possible to play with up to four people as well.
Yeah, actually, this is an aspect that moved and changed a lot during the entire production. It took us a lot of time to get where we are now, because we began the game as just being online game. Then it went back to be playable locally and online as well. So a lot of the multiplayer features design had to be adapted, obviously. And what we knew from the beginning, and that kind of haven't changed, I think, is that we wanted to relieve players from the material constraints of organizing a TTRPG. So we wanted to don't have to spend 1 hour and a half on each character's character sheets and stuff like that. We didn't want to have one person that is taking a week before to craft the campaign and everything. But we also wanted to transfer that feeling into something that was closer to choose your own adventure books, so that you can enjoy alone as well. This was there from the beginning. This is why the game is so text heavy, I guess. So yeah, this was the core feature, but we learned from our previous game that was also playable from 1 to 4 players. It was a puzzle platformer, so quite a different kind of game, but we learned a lot of things regarding cooperation dynamics. Sometimes it can be heavy to feel forced to cooperate when you just want to release tensions and everything. So we wanted Baladins to be able to embody this large spectrum of multiplayer experience. So you can go do your own thing. You can help friends when you want, but you can also not do it. This is kind of up to you every time. You can, I guess, kind of sabotage your friends during what we call guild choices, guild decisions. And you can also teleport your friends where you are, or just joining them. It's like a little slingshot thing where you cross the maps and your statistics are going to add up and everything. So yeah, we wanted cooperation to be highly, to be an incentive, but not to be forced in any way. Because what's interesting is giving the taste of cooperation to players and not just telling them you won't be able to go through the adventure if you do not want to do it.
Yeah, I think there is this idea of if you're together, some events are going to be easier. So you may want to spend the adventure together, but if you're sticking together, you can explore less. You can you can have a less broad range of actions and explore the regions and everything. So there is a balance to find between do we stick together or do we split as a team?
Yeah.
And I guess...
And maybe we can play two loops very differently, one after the other, just to unlock new situations.
But overall, there's an incentive of just explore on your own and then gather. And then you have this Avenger feeling of being together and to beat one event. And then you can, again, split and start exploring your own thing.
Yeah. You can just send items to your friends to get them out of a tricky situation as well. So it's it's never not a good thing to help each other out, but you don't have to do it. But it's never a bad thing.
It's interesting because when I was playing through, one of the first loops that I completed was, I collected an item which allowed me to pick up a sticker effectively, which would be able to say, hey, look, I'm from a time loop. Loop is, you know, and it basically the next loop, you kind of have to spend your entire term getting out there. And I could see that if you're playing in a multiplayer aspect, you might want some of your friends perhaps to go and work on something else while you are making the long journey off to go and complete this thing. And I'm curious about those aspects of continuous improvement as you're going through. Some of the best roguelikes do this really nicely, but you know, how do you do it so that people have to make sort of meaningful choices without being able to just breeze their way through?
It's tricky because Paladins takes a lot of, let's say, cosmetic elements from roguelikes, but it's actually not a real one. It's a very linear story. But yeah, the tricky part was to get rid of the dragon. You have to fill their stomach. Like you don't want to leave any space for them to eat time. So you have to gather things and give it to them. So sometimes you'll want to just do a run and gather things just to fill them up. And sometimes you are going to get grabbed into the story and everything. But this is pretty much up to you, I guess. And as we were saying earlier, it's up to each player individually in any case. But I guess the game is pretty low-key in terms of playstyle. Like, we didn't want to encourage a particular playstyle. Obviously, you have to get items at the end of the day, so you are going to do things to get them. But if you want to spend like an entire run just making bread, no one is forbidding you from doing so. But there is this thing in which, spoiler alert, the dragon is not that bad. They are not your enemy.
Misunderstood. They're just,
yeah, I mean, it's just there. So they are actually pretty friendly with you, and they allow you to take one item back with you in time at the end of each loop. And this is the only way in which you can build your character from loop to loop. You are not going to keep your stats updates and everything because, well, these events that made you stronger or more knowledgeable and everything did not happen. So you are not. But if you get like that super powerful, pickle box that makes you stronger when you try to open it, then you are going to be able to keep that in time with you, and you'll effectively be stronger in the next run. But it's just one per run. So we thought it was a pretty funny way to handle like character building, because, okay, it's very simple in a way, but you can rebuild every time you end the loop in the way that is going to match what you want to do in the next.
And I think content-wise, this is a game about stories, and you're building the availabilities of stories. Like, you will unlock content, you will unlock things in the story. Like, there will be some nodes that will be suddenly available the next time you play, and there will be some new regions that you can start from new region, and so you will explore differently. And this is how you build up not your character, but you build up the universe in a way that, like, the universe evolves slowly while you progress in the story. And that's the feeling of progression you will feel as a player.
It's such a beautiful world to explore, and I particularly love it. Just feels like little cardboard cutout standees that you have in that sort of board game world. Tell me a little bit about developing the art style and the look of this game, because the first thing anyone does when they load up the page, I'm sure, would just be struck by how gorgeous it is.
Yeah, what's funny is that Paladins was actually like the first idea, Fast Adventure, that John mentioned earlier, was pitched by our graphic artist, Alexandre. And he is really into like these little crafty maquette tilt shift kind of thing. He actually crafted in real life as well. He did a scene from Ballet Dance that is in a in a picture of third. But yeah, this idea of having this little plasticine-like environments with little ponds in it. Yeah, this idea of material physicality was at the core of his idea.
It felt like, at the beginning, it felt like a toy box. You're playing with a real board game. Everything was looking like wooden or plasticine toys. And then it built up, grew up in a more hybrid way because it's still a video game and there are some things that you want to have some freedom, like you want to bring animations and some fun things that maybe the real physicality would keep a bit limited. So then this kind of cut out
characters,
like standees in a way, they came up from this need of bringing animation, emotions and all of this. And we thought like, it's on the character that has to happen. So we still have the board that looks like a bit like a toy box, and then the characters are in there.
And kind of stickers.
They move and they have expressions and so on.
Yeah. But it was always about physicality in the end because all the animation in a game are hand-drawn. So it was also a way to like keep the handcrafted aspect alive everywhere in the game.
You funded the first part of this on Kickstarter, and that's often a place where I see a lot of video games go and make a board game adaptation. And I'm wondering if that's something you might be thinking about in your dreams, perhaps, that you might be able to have a real version of this for everyone to play.
Yeah, the Kickstarter campaign was fundamental for us just to launch the project and start the whole adventure. It was so scary and so important. And yeah, somehow since the beginning, we were thinking like, oh, we should make a real tabletop RPG or like a real board game box. It's still in the project, it's not done yet, but why not?
We do have the community unlocked one page RPG. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be available for backers.
This is the first step in the field, but if people like it, maybe we might expand.
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
I would love to.
We love board games, obviously. So it would be really fun to be able to work on one as well.
One of our programmer, Seamus, he said he has like 200 boxes or something of board games.
Yeah.
So that's crazy.
At least.
We all have a friend like that. They're the good friend to have because you can go over and,
yeah,
and spend time and you don't need to spend the money on it. So
exactly. And even when you just want to buy one yourself, you give them a call and you're like, okay, I want to offer one to my friend. They love this and this. Which one do you recommend?
Good advisor.
Yeah, exactly.
Real life board game geek is what you need, you know, something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about working as a cooperative studio, because it's something that I think is probably one of the most interesting ways to run a studio now, especially in the year or two that we've had where we see many different studios that have been owned by bigger companies being shut down. Tell me about what it's like to own and work together for something.
First of all, when we started the studio in 2018, it was kind of clear for us that we don't want to have a very hierarchical pyramid scheme.
We were all students together and we made the studio kind of right after our studies. So it felt really weird, like we all have the same diploma, and to just be like, okay, so you're the game designer, you are going to be paid less than the developer and everything, because we went to the same school together. So why some of us would kind of arbitrarily be less paid than the others? I think it was the first reflection.
But then as a principal, we started thinking on the value of work and all of this. And we were thinking like, if we were spending the same amount of time in the company with the same passion and dedication, like it feels weird to be paid different and to be valued different. Like all of us have the same type of dedication to work and to making something that we love. So from that came the idea that maybe we should share the value of work fairly. And in the same way, we each of us had a typical set of skills, and we know how to mobilize these skills in our area. But then maybe we should decide for ourselves on what we do. Like that sounds like pretty obvious when you say it like that, but I know how to make something, so I want to decide how to make it. Sure, we can discuss as a team and debate and share on our opinions and all of this, but eventually the person who has the skills should decide for themselves. So from there came all the thinking about like how we should take decision as a group, and maybe each person should own their own decision. So, and then three principles arise from that. First of all, we want to decide as individual on the task that we are doing as individual. That's the first thing. Then we want that everyone has a vote or a say in the big project of the company. Like, we don't want to work on a project we don't think respects our values or just feels not something that we're interested in.
Yeah, and we don't want to have one person stuck working for 3 years on a game that they hate just because the other people in the studio liked it. Like, we have absolute veto. As long as we don't find something that everyone is okay to work on, then we are not launching a project.
So individual decision.
One person has absolute veto as well? Is that all it takes, or do you need to have, is everything put to a vote? I'm just curious about how, if you have a big disagreement, how do you solve it?
If it's on the choice of the project that we are making, then one person saying, I don't want to work on that, is enough for the project to not be selected. Maybe it can go on as a side project or something, but we don't want to force anyone to work on something they don't want to work on. But after that, there is, like, as Jean was saying, the principle of the studio and the things that we want to bring to the industry. And fortunately on that, we are pretty much aligned. We don't want to make games that involve the violence metaphor as a core mechanic, for example. We can use things that are pretty similar in shapes, but we don't want it to be similar in tone. So yeah, this, for example, is one of the studio's principle. So on that, I can't answer you because the problem never arises. And after that, in the project themselves, basically it's a matter of trust. As Jean said, we have very different skill sets, very complementary ones. And at the end of the day, the person that is going to be the most affected in their work by a decision should be the one making it. And all of us just trust them because we know that we all want the best for both the project and the company. So we don't see each other as a concurrence. I don't know if it's a word in English, I guess. Like, we know that at the end, we all want the same thing. And yeah, it's trust. Yeah, it's hard to do with a big ego, I guess.
it seems a bit paradoxal to think that maybe everyone can veto an idea and then everyone is scared, like, it won't progress and there will be locked on all the time. But it's actually not the case. Like, the only thing that it would mean is that we don't have good ideas. Now, so if that happens at some point, that we can't make a new project because everyone is vetoing all the ideas, that means that as a team, we can't find a ground that we want to work all together. And that's a problem for the future. So as long as we can continue making game and no one is, and everyone is okay to make games that they don't want to veto, that means we are aligned. So that's basically also a sanity check for the team.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, having ideas is not the hard part of making a video game.
Everyone's got ideas.
So when we have to choose what is going to be the new project we're going to work on, even if some people veto some project, it's actually harder to find the ones that we don't want to work on than the one we want to work on. So it's like pretty much a fake problem.
I think because then we can't talk forever about cooperatives, but the last thing that we should say is that also we are sharing the value from the work evenly between everyone. And say evenly between everyone, it means also new employees and new people coming. Even if they're coming for short term, they will have a part in the profits at the end of the year, which is proportional to their time in the company. And we strongly believe that your work feels valued if it's the case, and you feel like you belong to the team and you want to have the same implication of everyone, participation in the project that everyone. And these are like fundamental to work properly in a good, safe environment.
Egality, fraternity, hey?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Do you have a producer? Do you have a producer in your studio?
I think it must be somewhere here between the two of us. we would probably need to have Antonin as well, because he's doing Trello planning kind of things, and remind us, you should check your tasks on Trello. But I would say from day to day, when problems emerge during the production process, most of the time, I guess I take care of it. But for all the high view part, it's definitely Jean.
It's interesting. I mean, the other big cooperative that I know of is Motion Twin, which is also based in France as well. And I'm just wondering, is there a lot of studios that are cooperatives based in France? Is it a growing thing? Because it is particularly in Australia where we are, it's actually quite complex to be a cooperative. We've had studios here who've tried it, but you know, the legal structure doesn't actually support it for game development, particularly for getting funding. And I know that you've had some funding from the government. So I'm just curious how that works. Is it a big thing? Is it an underrated thing about the French game development scene?
That's a lot of questions. But first of all, are there many companies? Yes, we made a check recently. We are four. So we are so many in the industry. No, it's not that frequent.
And actually, three of us are in this region.
Yeah.
Two of us even in the same town.
But it has a lot of momentum. So for example, for the record, just this year, there has been like three new creation in cooperative that we just met this year. And there is more. There are more to come, because many people are interested in the format and asking questions and all of this. Regarding the funding and the administration part, it's different in every country. In France, there is a legal framework that you can work in it, but basically it stays a company, regular company, and you just you decide to respect a set of rules, to force yourself to respect these rules, and if you do so, then you are a cooperative, and that's fine. And so it just gives you a framework, a template, as I can say, to start working together as a co-op. And then eventually, regarding the funding, it depends what type of funding you're searching for. If you're searching for project funding, it's not an issue. So most of the video game industry, I would say, is working on project funding based, meaning publishers. If you're looking for publishers, that's fine. They will not care at all of the fact that you're cooperative on any other type of legal entities. But if you're searching for equity funding, then that's an issue, because the cooperative is basically a set of rules that locks in the capital, and you will not make plus value on selling your shares, and you will not get dividends and all of this. So yeah, that's not interesting.
And
for
also you,
private equity.
Also, you won't get power, because the main idea of cooperative, at least in France, is that the weight of your voice during collective decisions is uncorrelated to how much you brought to the general capital of the company.
So that makes it a different business plan that you must have as a company, but it's totally manageable because the game industry allows that, to have like project-based funding, and that's fine.
It's a wonderful idea, and I wish there were more opportunities for studios all around the world to take up this option, because every week when we see another studio is shut down, a number of people lose their jobs. And, you know, the question always comes back to me. It's like, well, what would happen if investment money wasn't involved in those decisions in the same way that percentages on a spreadsheet were making the decision about people's lives? So I'm really always curious and interested to see how, you know, people can do it differently. And I find it kind of an admirable thing that you're able to do it. So so fascinating to learn more. Thank you so much for telling me a little bit more about it.
We are always happy to share about it. This is one of the things that we are, I guess, all of us very passionate about, because we're, as everyone else, we are very affected by the news that we see each day. And yeah, I wish there were, I guess, more studios that are worker-owned, but not just in the video game industry. Actually, I wish workers would own more things.
You are featured as part of LudoNarrowCon, which is on at the moment, as the time that people can watch this. But you're coming out very, very soon. It will be available for people. Baladins will be available on the 15th of May. And you can find out more information by heading to baladinsgame.com or look up Seed by Seed Games on your favorite social media platform. Thais and Jean, thank you so much for joining me on Lightmap. It's always a pleasure to chat to people from all around the world. And thank you so much for making a game that really made me smile.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thank you a lot.
You're listening to Lightmap, interesting conversations with video game creators.
Sifter is produced by Kyle Paletto, Fiona Bartholomeus, Courtney Borrett, Daniel Ang, Adam Christou, and Chris Button. Mitch Lowe is our senior producer, and my name is Gianni DiGiovanni, and I'm Sifter's executive producer. Thanks to Audio Technica Australia and Apple for their support of Sifter. And if you like this episode, subscribe to the show. Let your friends know that they can find out about cool games like Baladins. And you can do that for free by giving us a review on your favorite podcast player, but very genuinely sharing it with someone who enjoys conversations like this really does make a big difference. It makes a difference to us. It also makes a difference to the developers that we feature as well. And a recommendation, maybe getting your friends in the room to play a bit of multiplayer Baladins and say, I heard about it on this podcast. That makes a big difference. It's super easy. It's free. And it's a cool thing to do. That's all the time we have for now. We'll catch you on the next episode of Lightmap. Until next time. Have fun.
Hi, Chris Button here from Drop Rate, Sifter's video game review podcast. Hades 2 follows up the incredible roguelike from Supergiant Games.
And I always look at games, especially games that are coming out or games that are in early access or anything like that, and just look for fan art, look for, because that is, for me, a huge indication that this is a cultural item. This is something that has made an impact. And that's the thing about Hades 2. Chris, people are real horny for this one. They are real horny for it. And Kyle, who doesn't spend as much time online, seems to think that I'm the one who's going on about this all the time, but it's definitely not me.
But should you play it now in early access or wait for the final version? We have the definitive answer on Drop Rate, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.